you're listening to Taking Liberties. Taking Liberties is the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. On this episode, we open with a panel discussion on current events in voting rights. The panel discusses instances of voter suppression in Georgia, a Supreme Court ruling about voting law in North Dakota, recent litigation coming out of Arizona over the state's failure to comply with the National Voting Rights Act, and a ballot initiative in Michigan to create an independent redistricting commission. Then we'll hear from our guest for this episode, Professor Jed Purdy. Professor Purdy discusses how the Supreme Court's First Amendment jurisprudence has been transformed to advance powerful private interests and to entrench economic inequality. The panel was recorded on October 12, 2018, and the interview was recorded on October 19, 2018. Let's get started.
Welcome to this episode's Taking Liberties panel discussion. We're here to talk about some new and exciting events happening in the world of civil rights and civil liberties. My name is Joe.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Stephanie.
And in trying to decide what we were going to talk about this week, we wound up realizing that there were quite a few things happening over the last week or last month that relate to voter suppression and voting rights generally. So today sort of turned into our CRCL election special. So Emily, you brought us something related to ongoing litigation in Arizona related to the National Voter Registration Act.
Yeah, looking forward to discussing it.
And Stephanie, you've brought us something that might be good news, potentially.
Yes, let's hope so. I'd like to talk about the Michigan Ballot Initiative, Proposition 2.
Great. So there has been a lot of activity related to voting rights over the last couple of weeks. The one that's got the most attention of late is the fact that Georgia has suspended the registration of 53,000 applications for voter registration because they run afoul of the state's exact match law, which says that the name that you use on your voter registration application needs to match what is in the state's database or Social Security database exactly. So for example, a dropped hyphen or just some sort of misentry might lead to you getting flagged by this exact match law. So these 53,000 registrations are in limbo. The state of Georgia, their official response is that you can still show up to the polls on voting day with voter ID. So they argue that they haven't taken away anyone's right to vote as of yet. So one of the things that makes this interesting is that the person who is making these decisions, who's in charge of voter registration, is the Secretary of State, Matt Kemp, who is running for governor of Georgia, which is obviously coming up quick. And so these voters would have some say if their registration were approved in his electoral fortunes coming up very quickly. So that's interesting. And also very important to note is that 80% of these applications that were put into pending status were from minority voters, largely African American. So,
this is outrageous.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. You know, the exact response from the Secretary of State, I can't remember what representative said this, but they basically said that it's the fault of the voter registration organization that submitted all of these applications. The applications were compiled by the New Georgia Project, which has a goal of registering minority voters. And the Secretary of State's office has essentially said, well, the only reason that these minority voters are being flagged is because all of these messy applications came from an initiative that serves to register minority voters, which sort of seems like they're begging the question a little bit. In general, this is frustrating because their explanation or one of their excuses for it is that you can still vote on voting day with a photo ID. But obviously, photo ID is its own form of voter suppression. It also has extremely disparate impacts on minority groups. It is been seeing time and time again that it's more difficult for minority groups to get to the polls and acquire an ID. So their solution to suspending the registration of a group of minority voters is to tell them to show up to the polls with photo ID, well aware that photo ID poses its own restrictions and hurdles for those same minority voters. So it's pretty frustrating.
And I think it's important to mention that the context is that the Democratic candidate, Stacey Abrams, is a Black woman who is running on an explicit platform of empowering minority voters and, in general, bringing out the vote in Georgia, because she firmly believes that if you actually bring out the vote of all the people in Georgia, she could win. And so I think that just really highlights how egregious the effort to suppress minority voters is.
Yeah, and something else that stood out to me when I heard about this and was looking into it last night was that Brian Kemp is sort of a repeat player with these voter suppression laws, and this exact match policy was challenged just a couple of years ago, and then it was settled, and then the state legislature basically enacted this into law, and here it is being challenged again. Pretty interesting.
It also just seems like a very clear conflict of interest for Brian Kemp to be the person overseeing this if he is also running for governor.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree. One other frustrating piece of news before we talk about something slightly more positive is that North Dakota just got approval from the Supreme Court that they can enforce their voter ID law, which requires that voters show ID that includes a residential street address, which is a pretty significant problem for a large population of voters in North Dakota, which is Native Americans living on reservations. They usually don't have traditional residential street addresses, as they receive most of their mail via P.O. boxes. So this has the potential to keep tens of thousands of Native American voters from showing up to the polls on Election Day.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important race in North Dakota for Senator Heidi Heitkamp right now as well. You know, a Democrat in a red state, it's just a really important race, it seems.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that North Dakota's voter ID law, which has this pretty onerous restriction when you think about the populations in North Dakota who vote, was passed right after the 2012 election, when Heitkamp pulled off a pretty surprising win. So there's some talk that this rule specifically, both the voter ID law generally and maybe this provision, was in response to Heitkamp's surprising win in an otherwise pretty red state. It is interesting. Obviously, voter ID has been a big issue in states over the last couple of years. Emily, you and I were just talking before we started recording about how we're both in election law this semester with Professor Nicholas Stephanopoulos. Really interesting. And one of my favorite things about that class was going back and reading one of the first Supreme Court cases upholding any voter ID law, which was, I think, Indiana's in Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite things about that extremely frustrating opinion is that the Supreme Court goes out of their way in a footnote to say that they could not find nearly any instances of voter fraud in Indiana. I think the state in that case was able to produce one instance of fraud that they brought to the table. But as evidence of the fact that fraud exists in America, they cite to the fact that Boss Tweed ran a multi-voting racket like 100 years ago. And thus, because fraud is so prevalent in the American experience, these voter ID laws serve the important purpose of protecting our electoral integrity, which I found pretty ridiculous, the idea that if you can't find anything going on over the last 100 years, maybe there isn't quite as big of a problem as states are making it out to be.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, what year was that decision? Do you know, roughly?
Oh, mid-90s?
Maybe.
We can figure that out.
Well, I would say regardless of when that decision was made, since then, it's not like there's been an increase in any evidence. There is still evidence, or the evidence that we have is that voter fraud is extremely low.
Right. I pulled some facts on this before we came in to record, but So what year was the Crawford case decided?
Crawford was 2008, which is really interesting.
That's a lot more recent than I would have thought. Well, anyway, I pulled some numbers from Vox about how much in-person voter fraud was there between 2000 and 2014. And in-person voter fraud is the type of fraud that voter ID is really ostensibly supposed to protect against. And of 834 million ballots cast over that period, there were 35 credible allegations of in-person voter fraud. And even when you expand that to other types of fraud, when you look at alleged election fraud cases from 2000 through 2012, a period where more than 620 million votes were cast, there were only 2,068 alleged election fraud cases, period, of any kind. So at most, 2,068 alleged instances of fraud. Again, that's in a time span where more than 620 million votes were cast. And on that basis, there's ongoing voter suppression happening across the entire United States.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One thing that I wanted to talk about during this panel discussion was some litigation that was advanced at the end of the summer by a couple of different organizations, the ACLU, League of Women Voters, and essentially it had to do with the fact that Arizona is failing to comply with the National Voter Registration Act. And their allegation was that this is putting hundreds of thousands of people at risk of disenfranchisement. What the National Voter Registration Act requires is that anytime someone updates their address or their information at the Department of Motor Vehicles or wherever that might be, that should be simultaneously, that should be updated with their voter registration information, unless you opt out of that. And so in Arizona, this was requiring that individuals who update their information opt in. And what was interesting here is that Arizona was not disputing the fact that they were not compliant with this act. They simply said, okay, we'll update it next year when we're going through an update through our processes anyway. So back in November of 2017, the Secretary of State, Michelle Reagan, was warned that an investigation revealed a number of violations. The fact that voters had to opt in rather than opt out, that various changes that were made online were not automatically updated, information that was required to be provided to individuals was only available in English, it wasn't available in Spanish or other native languages. So they were aware that this litigation was coming. And then in August, League of Women Voters, Promise Arizona, with additional representation from ACLU and Demos, filed this litigation, and what they were asking for was that any provisional ballots that were cast by voters who were affected by this noncompliance be counted, and they would be mailed information on how to correct this problem. And what is the problem with the fact that your information is not automatically updated? Well, anyone who moves over the course of a decade or whatever it might be, would have to take this extra step to update their voter registration information. So any students, anyone in the military, anyone who's moving for work, whatever it might be, has this additional burden.
And not only that, they don't know that they have this burden, right? Because they're assuming if they update their address with the DMV that their voter registration address is updated because that's the law. So they wouldn't know that their registration is not updated, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and anyone who is planning to vote by mail would be expecting to receive their ballot by mail at the address that they assumed was automatically updated. And if they're not informed that their ballot, that they're not getting their ballot, they don't have the time to request that a new one be sent or request that their information be changed. So it's a pretty big deal. And the point is that these services are supposed to be provided by the state, and they simply were not in this case. So essentially, there was one additional wrinkle here, which is that there's a provision of Arizona law, which is that any provisional ballots are not counted if they're cast from out of precinct. So basically, this is why they were asking that any provisional ballots be counted in this case. The plaintiffs were asking for a preliminary injunction. But late last month, at the end of September, a district court in Arizona decided not to grant the preliminary injunction. So while the plaintiffs were hoping that this problem would be fixed ahead of the midterm elections, it's going to have to wait until next year to get relief for what's been found to be noncompliance with this act.
Wait, Emily, can you clarify that this provisional ballot issue that you're talking about, if a voter, say, had moved, and by the way, I read online that 70% of Arizonans changed their address between 2000 and 2010, 70%,
wow.
Second highest in the country. So this, you know, has massive ramifications. But I was just wondering if you know, if somebody shows up at their address where they live to vote that precinct, they, you know, my understanding, you can always request a provisional ballot if you're not on the rolls, right? And you're saying that if they then look at the provisional ballot and determine, oh, this person was registered at their old address, they won't count the provisional ballot?
So I don't know the details, but that's my understanding based on the description of this case on the ACLU's website.
Wow. I mean, that just sounds absurd to me.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, and the other surprising thing about this is I was looking at some reports online, was that between 1999 and 2016, which sort of coincides with these failures to sort of comply with this law, that the number of minorities registered to vote dropped by 60%, which seems like a pretty striking correlation or issue here.
Well, this has been kind of a bummer episode so far. Stephanie, is there any good news that you would like to share with us, or at least potential good news?
Yes, I would like to talk about an initiative on the Michigan ballot, Proposition 2, which is the Independent Redistricting Commission Initiative. So basically, this initiative is designed to end ultra-partisan gerrymandering, gerrymandering being apportioning districts to give advantage to one party or the other. This has become a growing issue over time. It's certainly been around for a long time, but in Michigan, it is one of the most gerrymandered states in the Union. So just for a little bit of context, in 2014, in the Michigan State Senate race, the popular vote was almost evenly split between Democrats and Republicans took 70% of the state Senate, giving them a supermajority. In 2016, Democrats actually won over 50% of the popular vote for the state House, and Republicans ended up with most of the seats. So the issue with gerrymandering clearly is that essentially some people's votes are not worth the same amount. If you, based on where you live, your vote can essentially not matter because the outcome is almost determined just by the way the districts are drawn. So this initiative would establish an independent commission that is completely separate from the legislature. Anybody, any registered Michigan voter can apply to be on the commission. They're doing a weird thing where anybody can apply, and they're also sending a certain amount, I want to say 20,000. They're randomly inviting people.
Okay.
However that works.
That's how more panels should be chosen, golden ticket style.
But you're invited to apply. Sorry. I should have clarified. So, no, they're not inviting 20,000 people to join. They're inviting people to apply, plus anybody else can apply. You can't have any sort of political affiliation, whether it's you or a relative or anything. And if you are chosen for the commission, you'll be ineligible to hold a partisan office for 5 years after serving on the commission. Also, the applications are weighted to mirror the geographic and demographic makeup of the state as much as possible, and ultimately they will have 4 Republicans, 4 Democrats, and 5 independent or third-party members who will be randomly selected from the pool of qualified applicants.
And how long does someone hold this position once they're on the commission?
So I believe one commission equals one redistricting, and okay. Redistricting happens every 10 years based on the census, is my understanding.
Okay.
Also, a second key factor of the initiative is transparency. The commission will have at least 10 public meetings before they come up with a proposed plan. And then after they have a proposed plan, there will be at least 5 public hearings for comments and feedback. They have to use a computer source code, and that code must be made public so people can look at it and pick it apart. The legislature and governor are prohibited from reorganizing or altering the commission. So if they're not happy with who ends up on the commission, too bad for them. And in the event of a deadlock, the commission votes using a ranked choice procedure. So it is designed that the commission ultimately will be able to vote and come up with an outcome. The legislature and governor will never need to get involved, and ideally the courts either. That's the goal. They have 7 criteria that they go through in order when drawing districts, starting with following federal laws. That should be a given.
Hopefully. That makes sense.
The districts have to be contiguous, so single and unbroken. The next category is that they reflect Michigan's diverse population and communities of interest, which is interesting. So that's to avoid either packing all people of a certain cultural or economic interest together into one district or cracking them by splitting them apart and then diluting their votes. Also, the maps can't give a disproportionate advantage to any certain political party, so your party affiliation cannot be considered a part of your community of interest. Oh, and I should say, on the communities of interest, members of the public will be able to give input as to what they think their community of interest is. So they can have some influence if the commission isn't thinking of a particular group, for example. And those public meetings, by the way, will also be virtually broadcast and allow for virtual comment, which I think is very cool.
21st century.
Imagine that. We're in the 21st century, and you don't need to physically go to a town hall to participate.
That's great.
Yeah, something that really stood out to me about this was how much they emphasize transparency as part of this new process. I remember you hear about these district maps that are drawn sort of in hotel rooms and bunkers away from the public, and it seems like this effort is really trying to combat that.
Yeah, there are other states that have completely independent commissions. Actually, Arizona is one of them, so barring voter suppression, ideally you would have a good process there, in theory. So is California, and those 2 states in particular have been studied, and it's shown that competition is increased when you have independent commissions. Also, there are other ballots. I know Colorado also has a similar initiative to establish an independent commission, and so does Utah. So what I think is especially interesting about this is, given that Congress does not have an incentive to fix gerrymandering, no Congress, no legislature does. If you're in power, you don't want to draw districts that could potentially give you less power. You know, historically, we had a landmark case, Baker v. Carr, in 1962. You two are in election law, but I'm pretty sure that's right.
Yeah.
Baker v. Carr in 1962, where the Supreme Court did mandate that districts be reapportioned. At the time, legislatures were not reapportioning, and urban and suburban districts, those voters basically had no power. And that was a huge issue. Justice Frankfurter had a stroke soon after and never decided a case again. He thought it was an egregious judicial overreach, but the court did hold that that was a justiciable question. And if you think about it, if you can't rely on a legislature to apportion votes, well, then you have the courts, right? But given the current makeup of our courts, we probably can't rely on them either. And just last year in Gill v. Whitford, there was a big gerrymandering case brought to the Supreme Court, and they kicked it down and essentially refused to hear it on the merits. Given the new makeup of the court, I don't expect them to take on gerrymandering soon, although it shouldn't be a partisan issue. Right. Both parties do gerrymander. I think currently Republicans are doing it more, but historically that's not necessarily true. But I like the idea of initiatives that are bringing the power back to the actual people. Assuming their votes are not suppressed, they can bring about this change through that process.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. And I had not heard a lot about this before we started getting ready for this recording session. Are people optimistic about this initiative passing?
I think currently people are cautiously optimistic. I actually couldn't find any major press that came out against it, which is great. There are some Republican politicians in the state that are coming out against it, but there just aren't very good arguments against it.
Right.
That I've been seeing that people are really making, except that they say, oh, well, this is the power of the legislature to do this, so you should let us do it. But if they're not doing it well, and there's such clear evidence that, you know, they're not actually serving their people by providing them, you know, with one person, one vote, essentially, put it in the people's hands.
Right. Well, and the fact that it's going to be the people voting to institute this panel takes away a lot of that punch, the idea that, oh, well, this should be the legislature's job. Well, here's the people who are voting for the legislature saying, we think that these people would do an even better job. So I think that's a really cool idea.
Yeah, and I think it's just it increases sort of accountability and sort of trust when it's the people that are really taking this matter into their own hands, and that's something that is important.
I completely agree, and I just want to add, by the way, in case you were worried, in 2015, the Supreme Court did rule that independent redistricting commissions are constitutional, so hopefully that won't be challenged in the future.
I mean, another reason I think that this partisan gerrymandering issue is so important, especially right now, leading up to 2020, when there'll be another census and another round of redistricting. I mean, it coincides with these midterm elections that are happening, a lot of gubernatorial races, governor races, and the governor holds the veto power on any redistricting, correct? So it just seems like a really important moment right now to challenge the entrenchment that we're seeing in a lot of districts, a lot of places around the country.
Yeah, I think the point that, Stephanie, you made earlier about the fact that both sides can gerrymander effectively does not mean that it's good policy. It seems like no matter what, if districts aren't representing the people who live in them or if the state legislatures aren't representing the state as a whole, no matter who is over or underrepresented, it's never good news.
Absolutely. It's a race to the bottom.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, you know, I think we've had a lot of conversations today about some things that we're looking forward to, some things that are ongoing and still frustrating about our current voting system, and obviously some frustrating voter suppression news. I think it would be fun to jump into a conversation we were having right before we turn on the microphones, which is if you could make one change to voting law, you got to be the Tsar of the United States and change voting somehow, what would you do?
I would have automatic voting registration. When you're of age, you are, boom, registered.
Yeah, that's a great one. I mean, I think another important one would just be make Election Day a national holiday.
Yes.
In favor of that. Another one that I think is interesting is compulsory voting. I don't know how you guys feel about that. Pros or cons?
I'm open to it, certainly.
I'm open to it, too. I know we were talking earlier, I believe in Australia, where they have compulsory voting, you can go to the polls and vote yes, no, or essentially abstain, an abstention. And so that, I think, takes away a little bit of teeth from people who say, well, then you'll have a bunch of uninformed voters. I think I'm open to it, personally, especially if Election Day is a holiday. There's no excuse. Especially if you can get more absentee ballots and just make voting more accessible in general.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I would second especially the idea of a voting holiday. I think Election Day being a national holiday is a very good idea. And I believe that's what most other countries do, right? Or at least a good number of them. So it seems like we're all in agreement that things that make it easier to vote are in general better. So it's interesting to see that in a lot of places the trend is going the opposite direction, but who knows, maybe the effects of these independent commissions will wind up reverberating through other voting rights as well, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Another thing, sorry, just to go back. Another thing that I really found interesting about the Michigan Ballot Initiative is its origin story as a Facebook post that generated just a ton of interest around the state of Michigan. It's just a nice little anecdote to underscore how this is really about putting the power back into the hands of the people to make sure that they're being represented.
Yeah, that's a great point. It was just a civilian's post putting out the idea, and I believe it garnered, what, tens of thousands of signatures to the petition in just a couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, none of my Facebook posts have ever wound up influencing the law, but that's how it goes sometimes. Maybe someday for all of us. That'd be great. Well, in as much as we can take a stand on any sort of political issue, I would say that CRCL and Taking Liberties is vehemently pro-voting. So make sure you're registered. If a registration date has passed, hopefully you did register. Make sure you get it to the polls on Election Day. Any final thoughts?
Remember, you can always ask for a provisional ballot, even if it's not counted later. That is your right.
Great. Yeah. Get out and make your voice heard.
That's the word. Well, thanks, everybody.
Hello, and thank you for listening to Taking Liberties, the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. We are really lucky to have Professor Jed Purdy joining us today. Professor Purdy is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law at Duke Law School, where he teaches and writes widely on a variety of subjects, including constitutional law, property, environmental law, and legal theory. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on all of these areas of the law, Professor Purdy, but one topic that I'm really eager to speak with you about today is some of your current work and your recent work on the First Amendment and sort of how we should be thinking about the Supreme Court at the moment. So thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks, Emily. I'm glad to have the chance to talk with you.
Great. So you have a piece titled Beyond the Boss's Constitution, Political Economy for a Democratic First Amendment, and you also published a piece in The Nation called The Boss's Constitution. I thought these were just really original and important pieces, which I take it came out of a Columbia Law Review symposium.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, and if you could just walk us through your argument here. My understanding, you know, the First Amendment was once a really powerful shield for defending individual rights, but lately it's been transformed into a sort of total deregulatory tool, and the implications of this is that it mainly advances protections for private economic interests, powerful elite actors over more vulnerable groups. And you explain how this is the sort of weaponization, but it's not just a product of the Roberts Court, but it goes back farther. Could you just walk us through the history and when you think this turn happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So I should make a couple of small distinctions. The First Amendment still remains a pretty powerful tool to limit the regulation or criminalization of political argument and political dissent. Ironically, that development is much more recent than many people realize. As late as 1952, the Supreme Court upheld the criminal prosecution of members of the American Communist Party for advocating revolution. But after 1969, and really a little before that, the modern full dress protection for political speech was in place. Only 7 years after that, in 1976, the court issued a couple of opinions. Influenced, one of them was authored by Justice Powell. I think both were influenced by Justice Powell, which becomes relevant in a moment, that carried the protection of political speech and public argument into the economic domain and into the use of wealth in political campaigns in particular. The first case was Buckley v. Valeo. It was a consideration of the sweeping campaign regulation law that had been passed after Watergate. And it established the principles that are that often get associated mistakenly with Citizens United, that political spending qualifies for pretty much full dress speech protection, that for this reason there can't be any limits on individual expenditures on campaigns. All Citizens United did was fold corporations into that protection by treating them as individuals. And especially, Buckley v. Valeo said that there's no role in American campaign regulation for redistribution of, I think more accurately, just distributional judgments about speech. That is, there's no role for regulation in trying to equalize access to political argument or campaign advocacy. So that really scorched the ground in terms of what lawmakers could do to shape campaigns, and pretty much unleashed the campaign finance ecology that we have now. Now, there have been important developments since. The other opinion in 76, moving a little faster, started to apply First Amendment scrutiny to advertising and other forms of commercial communication, and this has been extended and to turn the First Amendment into a potential knockout tool against any regulation that requires or prohibits corporate communication or disclosure of data, which, of course, in an information-heavy and communication-heavy economy, and in a world where a lot of regulatory regimes depend on mandatory disclosure and other kinds of transparency, that this is a tool for shooting holes in lots of regulatory regimes. So I'll stop in a second to let you keep talking, but it happened in the mid-70s, and it happened on the heels of Justice Powell and a couple of other Nixon appointees joining the court. Justice Powell, as some of your listeners will know, within a year before he joined the court, wrote a memo to the Chamber of Commerce in which he advocated for a full court press by American business against what he described as creeping socialism and a loss of faith in the free enterprise system. So I think you can understand the development of jurisprudence in the mid-70s as a kind of re-entrenchment of anti-redistributional, he said free enterprise system, but really pro-capitalist or pro a certain version of capitalist jurisprudence.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. Thank you for that overview. I guess I'm also just curious. So it seems like your piece and the symposium that it was a part of are part of a discussion on what's sort of deemed First Amendment Lochnerism. And I'm just curious if you have thoughts on that analogy or why the First Amendment in particular is this site for struggle over inequality as opposed to 14th Amendment or other areas of the law. Like, how did that happen?
Right. Well, good. So, I mean, there is, I would say, a fight over inequality in other areas as well. So, the colorblind or anti-affirmative action jurisprudence of the 14th Amendment, which I think we are likely to see finally triumph on the Kavanaugh-Trump court, is a very strong anti-distributional principle of formal equality, that is identical formal treatment, against substantive equality, against any kind of equality of outcomes or even versions of equality that take structural racism and other background conditions into account. So in that way, the First Amendment jurisprudence, I think, is part of a broader field of equality quashing constitutional developments. So I think the reason that the First Amendment is doing some of the same work that the idea of freedom of contract that was derived from the 14th Amendment did in the Lochner era at the end of the 19th and the early 20th centuries is that both the idea of freedom of contract and the protections of speech and association in the First Amendment can be understood as protecting transactions that are right at the heart of economic life and ordering in a market regime, because all market coordination involves contracts or other person-to-person or person-to-company agreements, and all transactions involve communication, expression. So with some work on the kind of legal category or metaphors of communication, expression, association, you can shoehorn a lot of forms of human collaboration into the category of speech, especially when every use of money is potentially treated as an expressive act. So I think there are sort of two things. One is rooted in the way the doctrine is just cast as a potentially very general way of describing interpersonal activity generally. That gives a lot of room to turn it into a sort of free-roaming deregulatory device. And then I think the second fact is that the First Amendment has very high prestige. It had been expanding rather than contracting, which was, of course, not true of the Lochner-era 14th Amendment. So it was a tool that was available and it got picked up. That's the simpler and other side of the story.
Yeah. Okay, great. And sort of now that we've discussed sort of where this First Amendment jurisprudence or how it's developed and sort of where it might be going, I want to turn to your sort of vision for how we can rehabilitate it or think about it in new ways. Because it seems like a view of a social democratic First Amendment or a democratic First Amendment really requires a view towards sort of truly systemic change. And so when you think about or envision an egalitarian First Amendment, and maybe this even tracks your recent sort of op-ed in the New York Times about what a progressive constitutionalism looks mm-hmm. like, what do you see as the path forward? The role of federal courts, state courts, agencies, politics, or popular politics more generally? So I'd love to hear you sort of speak on that.
Yeah, totally. So I think that the First Amendment is not likely to be a super powerful tool for achieving egalitarian goals. I think the main thing that it can do is get out of the way, or that courts can do with the First Amendment is to get out of the way. At the moment, the amendment is being used as a way of knocking out some of the most potentially important egalitarian legislation, corporate regulation generally, but also specifically laws supporting public sector unions, as in the Janus, the Ask Me, it's very hard to say, a case from last term, and of course in campaign finance. So when it comes to the First Amendment, the chief thing that I would want to see would be just what I've called a jurisprudence of permission, that is not undercutting what the more popular, the electoral branches do on the egalitarianism front. So I think that puts the real onus on popular movements pushing, replacing elected officials and pushing elected officials to make egalitarian moves in these domains. I think the thing to do with respect to the courts is to incorporate into that broader popular mobilization a picture of what constitutional review should and shouldn't be doing, that's rooted in the recognition that you can't have anything like meaningful equal citizenship or self-rule if you don't have some substantial degree of economic security and equality of power, or at the very least, control and mitigation of extremes of concentration of wealth and economic power. So I think in some ways, what we need from the First Amendment is a boring old version of the New Deal Compromise, which said that basically courts don't get involved in the regulation of economic life or economic power. But I think the reason needs to be quite explicit and upfront, which it actually was for some New Deal justices like Frankfurter. And it just needs to be said that the reason that legislatures need to be free to make the kinds of interventions that the courts have been striking down is that you can't have a real democracy without them. And that a court that's invalidating those measures is working as an anti-democratic force. So at a deep level, you need a democratic vision of what the Constitution is there to do, and you need political and social mobilization that includes that idea.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. It's obviously a topic that's on a lot of people's minds in the past month or so, and I think there's a lot of energy in thinking about it, so thank you for that. But I guess just one other question as far as the counterargument to the jurisprudence of permission. I'm just curious, is there any space where there is a benefit to arguing for more expansive First Amendment protections, either in the voting rights context or any kind of election law context, or not? Given, I don't know, I'm curious for your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah. So there have been arguments which you're alluding to, I think, to the effect that the associational right in the First Amendment should require fusion voting, for example, of the kind that the Working Families Party uses on the ballot in New York to permit people to vote on the left without throwing their vote away. And that's very interesting. That was struck down in, I think, the late 90s. And I know that associational rights have been advanced as part of the case against partisan gerrymandering.
Right.
I haven't looked at that those arguments very carefully, so I'm not in the best position to comment responsibly on them. I generally had the thought that you can get egalitarian or inegalitarian ideas into a lot of different, into several different constitutional concepts. You can get them into the 14th Amendment. You can get them into the First Amendment. And I'm pretty anti-essentialist in my sense of what the different amendments and their associated phrases can do. So I think those goals are good. If I were optimistic about getting the results out of the doctrine, I'd be pleased for it. But at this point, I tend to prefer to see an equality-based argument that probably resonates more with the 14th Amendment, in part because that was so important to the more generally egalitarian vision that the Warren Court developed and that was present in the sort of post-New Deal era. And at this point, the First Amendment is so tied up with the kind of anti-regulatory and libertarian measures we're talking about, that it's somewhat treacherous ground.
Yeah.
But that's just sort of prudential guesswork. As I say, I think people can do different things with different amendments to a really kind of head-spinning degree.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I was thinking in particular about the sort of redistricting context, but I hear you and I think I agree with you. I have a couple more questions on your work here, but I'm also just curious more generally. I know you work on a number of different areas of the law, and You've done research and writing on environmental law and other areas of constitutional political economy generally. What are you working on next? Are there other areas of the law that give you hope for sort of advancing progressive civil liberties?
I have sort of, to take the last part of the question first, I have sort of a modicum of hope that at least in state courts, and maybe within our professional lifetimes, maybe even my professional lifetime, if there's an electoral term, we may see some real pressure brought to bear on the racialized carceral system. I think the increasing awareness of structurally disparate experiences of law enforcement and incarceration is really alerting people to a theme that got raised in the 70s and 80s and then decisively shut down by that same post-Nixon Supreme Court, that you just can't square the idea of constitutional equality with the disparate ways that the criminal justice system touches and breaks people's lives. So I have some optimism about hope, not short-term optimism, but medium-term hope there. And I have some as well that the ways that the Trump administration's border policies and responses to it have highlighted the extreme vulnerability and lack of any kind of meaningful due process that that non-citizens face at virtually every stage of their encounter with U.S. law may spark a revival and extension of due process and equal protection guarantees for non-citizens in high-stakes encounters with the U.S. government. So I have some hope there. As for what I'm doing right now, so two things. I've been working with a network of people, law faculty, and we hope increasingly law students, though our students are mostly just clustered at Yale right now for historical reasons, on developing what we call a law and political economy approach to scholarship and to teaching. We're hoping to generate a cohort of people who think systematically about the role of power throughout the operation of law, about the way that the economy is constituted by law and constantly in interaction with principles of equality or inequality, self-rule or the denial of self-rule, and the ways that what are often called public law, like constitutional principles, are deeply involved in the shaping of economic power. So we're excited about this. We think it's a realistic view of law that captures some of the themes that people are feeling are urgent in this moment and ways that the established ways of proceeding, either in sort of rights-oriented public law or in efficiency-oriented private law, kind of fail to do. Paradigms of this are the new attention to antitrust, new and more aggressive attention to how labor law and how it intersects with constitutional doctrine, the effort to bring class entrenchment and economic power squarely into constitutional reasoning in the Voss's Constitution piece that you mentioned. So we think this is really important and something that takes generation, or at least a cohort, rather than just a few people. So we're hoping to try to start building that out, and we'll be announcing some initiatives in the next few months, we hope. I'm working on a book over the next couple of years that's tentatively called Democracy or Barbarism, and it steps outside of the law space somewhat, though it'll definitely be deeply concerned with law because law just runs through all of these things. But it's basically about what you need to have meaningful self-rule and equality within a society and how bad things can become when you give up on that.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, as and you alluded to this earlier as well in your piece, you sort of talk about the tension between self-rule on one side and economic inequality on the other. And just listening to you talk about your work on those questions of power and political economy and public law, I mean, it truly feels like these are the real questions of our time. And I think your work on this is so innovative. So thank you for discussing it with us.
I really appreciate that. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that we can involve some of your comrades and you in what we're doing.
You've been listening to Taking Liberties, the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. Music for the podcast was written and performed by John Sada. Our panelists today were Joe Meeker, Emily Morrow, and Stephanie Horwitz. The editors-in-chief of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review are Bree Frank, Amber Ashley James, and Ian Epler. The executive audio content editor is Mark Sada. Special thanks to our guest, Professor Jed Purdy, and thanks to you for listening.